coming up on this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Behind many of these chemicals is a story of companies knowing there were problems and not complying with the duty to explain that this is toxic stuff.
Hey everyone, it's Dr. Mark. Now, I know there are a ton of functional medicine practitioners who listen to this podcast, and I want to ask you a question. Are you tired of wasting valuable time on complex lab ordering procedures? If so, I got fantastic news for you. Rupa Health has revolutionized the process for ordering labs, and in just a few clicks, you can access over 3,000 tests from over 35 companies, all in one convenient portal. Plus, Rupa Health ensures that you pay only one invoice for all your tests, making everything simpler and more efficient. No more juggling multiple invoices or dealing with administrative headaches. And the best part, it's completely free. That's right, there are no hidden fees. So don't let lab ordering hold you back anymore. Visit rupahealth.com today and unlock the potential of hassle-free lab testing. That's rupahealth.com. Protein is a foundational component of many health diets, including my own vegan diet. But too often, the meat and seafood you get at the store has been raised unsustainably and contains harmful compounds that should never have been there in the first place. So if you're looking for quality proteins that are better for you and the environment, my friends at ButcherBox can help. ButcherBox makes it super easy to get humanely raised meat that you can trust by delivering right to your doorstep. ButcherBox has everything you could want, like 100% grass-fed and grass-finished beef, and shipping is always free. ButcherBox is committed to humanely raised animals that are never given antibiotics or added hormones, and since they take out the middleman, you get the extra savings. There is a major stipulation I always tell my patients about when it comes to animal protein. Quality needs to be a priority. And with ButcherBox, you can feel good knowing you're getting the highest quality meat and seafood that will help you thrive. For a limited time, new subscribers to ButcherBox will receive ground beef for life. When you sign up today, ButcherBox will send you 2 pounds of 100% grass-finished beef free in every box for the life of your subscription and $20 off. To receive this offer, go to butcherbox.com/pharmacy, F-A-R-M-A-C-Y. That's butcherbox.com/pharmacy. And now, let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Hi, this is Lauren Feehan, one of the producers of The Doctor's Pharmacy podcast. Toxins in our home environment, our food, and in the air all increase our risk of chronic disease. Learning about the impact of these hidden chemicals and where they are commonly found can empower us to make better choices as consumers, to limit our exposure, and to create better health for ourselves and our families. In today's episode, we feature 3 conversations from the Doctor's Pharmacy about toxins that are found everywhere from canned tuna to our personal care products, and why it's a good idea to reduce your toxic load. Dr. Hyman speaks with Ken Cook about glyphosate in our food and the work of the Environmental Working Group, with Dr. Elizabeth Boehm about heavy metals like lead and mercury, and with Maggie Ward about how to test for toxins and how to uplevel your detoxification pathways. Let's jump in.
This was a weed killer that came along really in force in the 90s. It was invented much earlier, but in the 90s it was matched to bioengineering technology that allowed them to develop crops that were resistant to the weed killer. So you could spray a field while the crop was standing in it, after it had been planted and it had popped up, you could spray that field and kill all the weeds, but the crop would survive. That's the genesis of why we have so much Roundup in our world now, used on, as you say, hundreds of millions of acres. It's in air in the Midwest during the spray season. It comes down in the rain. It's everywhere. I liken it to, in a way, sort of the OxyContin, right? It was something that at the beginning had some merit, obviously, for a therapeutic treatment of severe pain. And this was not the worst weed killer molecule out there, glyphosate. There are others that are worse. What made it so bad was the greed to take it from a certain market level to a mass market level, multi-billion dollar market level, where it was used everywhere and abused. So what we face now is it's in air, it's in water, it's in all of us. Then they started using it at the end of the growing season for other crops that weren't genetically engineered to resist it, like wheat and oats. So they would spray wheat and oats right at the end of the season when it had grain on it. And that's probably why you got your 50th percentile, because when they did that late in the season, it was right there in the final food. And when that went to the miller, it stayed in. And when it went to the baker, it stayed in and it came out. It's in hummus. We found it there. It's in Cheerios.
Yeah. People don't realize it's the number one top product that contains glyphosate the most amount is hummus.
Yeah.
Which is and crazy.
It's bizarre, right?
And people are eating it to get healthy.
Right. And so, because it was used on, you know, used on chickpeas at the end of the growing season to make the harvest easier and it's cheap. And so, so all of these abuses, first of all, those end of season abuses, which probably account for most of the dietary exposure, the Biden administration should just go in and say no more post-harvest or, you know, end of harvest use of glyphosate. That would immediately lower a lot of the exposure that we, you know, we experience in the food supply. But it really, it's a story about mistakes we make over and over again in agriculture, where lunging for that big market, you know, growing as much corn as you can, growing as much soybean as you can, and have the pesticides and fertilizers to go with. Everybody makes a lot of money as long as the system's working, but the accountability for the environment and health is close to non-existent. So for glyphosate, what we're saying now is, look, at minimum, we should end all of this late season use that gets it in our food. And then we should dramatically reduce use in residential and home situations where it's sprayed oftentimes by groundsmen. These are a lot of the cases that are the subject of the litigation now. They're spraying it out of backpack sprayers around their properties and so forth. That needs to end. We need to put very tight controls on that, if not banning the compound altogether. And then for agriculture generally, I think we need investments in systems that don't require this heavy use of Roundup. They're available and out there, but they're starved for money. Farmers, you know, like all the rest of us, we do the things that we do. If someone told me this, the camera here on this computer was carcinogenic and I couldn't use it anymore, I'd be concerned. Right. So, but these are tools.
Yeah.
We can fix the tools. Yeah. And that's what we need to have, you know, the leadership at the federal level to do, because the companies won't do it themselves. And what we've learned from so many of these cases you mentioned is there's consideration now of a multi-billion dollar, like a $12 billion settlement of thousands of cases where people have developed cancer. They've gone to court and said it was caused by glyphosate. And they've won a lot of these court cases. What we really need to think through is that if going forward we can avoid some of these chemical exposures and reduce that cancer incidence, and if we can make sure that when these suits are settled, they direct Monsanto, now Bayer, to make some changes in how this chemical is used in the economy, we'd be much better off. But the real thing that has broken through here is when we, from the discovery in these lawsuits, we've realized that Monsanto knew a long time ago that there were problems with this chemical. They didn't tell anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
They hid the information, but that has come out now in juries, and that's really what gets men on juries upset. It's not the toxicity per se.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
that they were lied to, right? And I think that behind many of these chemicals, PFAS chemicals, the Teflon chemicals, many of the pesticides we worry about, behind them is a story of companies knowing there were problems and not being required to, or not complying with the duty to report and explain that this is toxic stuff. They knew,
yeah.
but they didn't tell us.
Now, the Environmental Working Group has been really at the forefront of highlighting these chemicals, doing the research on them, bringing this to light to policymakers. And maybe you could share a little bit of the successes that you've had sure. around getting rid of these chemicals in our food, water, air, agriculture, because I don't think there's been any other group that has been as effective in using science and data to change policy as the Environmental Working Group.
Oh, well, thanks. Well, and I know you start with science yourself, so I really appreciate the compliment coming from you, Mark. No, we've gone about in a number of ways. One way is we do research and present it to federal agencies. We take it to Capitol Hill and make the case, hey, look, this chemical is posing risks that shouldn't be accepted. We need to fix our regulatory system. We need to enact stronger laws. We need to take action in regulatory agencies. And we've had considerable success on a number of chemicals, like the perfluorinated chemicals, the Teflon chemicals. We were instrumental in getting federal action on a few of those. Much more needs to be done. Chlorpyrifos, our work in the 90s help take it out of a lot of uses, particularly around the home. And there are many other examples.
But that's a pesticide?
That's a pesticide. Chlorpyrifos is a bug killer, an insecticide. So pesticides are weed killers, bug killers, rodenticides that kill rats and stuff. In that mix, the insecticides and fungicides tend to be some of the most toxic, and we've worked on all of those as well as Roundup. But you know, the real thing that's changed, Mark, and it's been exciting to see it. We don't know exactly where it's going to go. Because the internet allows us to engage with so many people simultaneously and get feedback from them and inform them at a pretty low cost point. We don't have to go through a front page story in the New York Times to get information to people anymore.
Yeah.
They can come directly to us. They can come to your podcasts and so forth. That has begun to build an awareness in people that companies are beginning to listen to. I mean, it's behind the growth in organic food and agriculture, certainly behind efforts to clean up personal care products, the work we've done raiding cosmetics and cleaning products and so forth. What I'm excited about now is that we no longer have to just rely on the government taking action as the first step. We can start with consumers taking action to protect themselves and their families, companies starting to listen to that. And we often then find the companies come with us to Capitol Hill and say, you know, it's time to change the playing field, add some tough new rules. Our consumers want it. The market's demanding it. Let's take action. So it's instead of really saying that the market is substituting for the government, it's really market forces that can be harnessed to support civil action, to support change at the regulatory level and the legislative level. We're seeing just this year, we had almost two dozen chemicals banned in California from personal care products. We had the agreement of the industry to do it. They were outmoded. Some companies still use them, but not the majority. Consumers were rejecting them in the marketplace. And so we came together with the trade association for the cosmetics industry and worked together to get those banned. That's beginning to happen more and more often. So it's different than the way it worked when I was coming up as a lobbyist, where you'd take science to Capitol Hill, you'd hear feedback from bipartisan people of goodwill. They'd pass a law, they'd pass regulations after the law, and industry would comply. Doesn't work that way anymore. Now it's science comes out, consumers see it first in many cases. They start changing their behavior. Companies pay attention. When they pay attention, they realize that maybe they need to go to the government, because if they're doing the right thing and other companies are sneaking by and doing the bad thing, they're at an economic disadvantage for what they're trying to do the right way. So it's just shifted the dynamics in some interesting ways.
Well, so think about
your personal
WG.
Behavior can matter, not just for your own health, but when you add it up in the marketplace, it creates a demand for better behavior from companies, and that's translating into policy slowly.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I want to talk about next, because EW is not only focused on the hard work of bringing science to policymakers and getting various chemicals banned or regulated. You've created an interface with the consumer, which has actually been among your most successful efforts, because you could bang your head against the wall a long time in Congress and the White House and agencies. And you realize that by going directly to the consumer and providing them with tools to understand what they were exposed to and how to avoid those chemicals, that it creates the demand, which then drives the free market businesses to change their supply, which then wants them to change the regulation. So it's this beautiful virtuous cycle. So let's talk about some of the things, because I think, you know, most people don't understand. If you just go to EWG.org, there's an enormous amount of resources there that are really available and pretty much free, including the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15 list of which are the most contaminated and least contaminated fruits and vegetables, the Skin Deep resource database, which looks at skincare products, which is probably what you use to do the regulatory changes in California.
Yep.
Absolutely. What household products you should be using or not using. If you're eating animal products, which ones are the best for you and the environment? Which fish you should consume that's grown harvested or farmed sustainably that also is the least toxic. So you have all these incredible resources that are really user-friendly, that are often on apps that allow people to really at the point of sale find out if their toothpaste or their face cream or their, you know, broccoli is safe to eat or consume or put on their skin. And it's really incredible. An incredible resource that I don't think most people understand. And I was shocked to learn when I joined the board of the Environmental Working Group about how much data there is that drives these apps. Yeah. There's just, you've got teams of scientists combing the research database and then putting it in a user-friendly form. No one's going to go on PubMed and read 15,000 papers. But you guys did.
We will. So you don't have to. Right. And, I know you do it, but yeah, that's right. Most
I don't
people
know.
Won't. Of course not.
And they won't. And you synthesize that into these incredible tools. So talk about the development of these tools. What do they do? Tell us about some of these things that you've created that help people change their lives and change their health and drive the change in the marketplace and ultimately the policy.
Well, it's one of my favorite things to talk about because it was my failure of imagination that led us there. In a way, we started as a policy shop where we thought our job was to bring information to the forefront so that policymakers would take action and things would get better. This was the environmental model for a long time. And it still would be without the internet. We'd have very few tools to make the marketplace change, but the internet's changed all of that, of course. But our first endeavor was the Dirty Dozen. So here we are, we're making the case that we should get some pesticides off the market that are sketchy. Right? They may cause a threat to the nervous system. They might be carcinogenic, even mildly carcinogenic. If you don't want to eat a lot of that, if you can avoid it, they might cause problems for the endocrine system. They might affect the immune system. All these biological effects that we saw in the open literature and even the government regulators were pointing to, but they couldn't get the job done. They couldn't get the pesticide off the market or out of the foods that we wanted it out of. So we thought, well, why don't we just show people how they can shop for themselves? We know organic will get you out of most of those whack-a-mole problems with the chemical toxin of the day, just buy organic. But what about conventional, where maybe the levels are low and we found government data, we still use it every year, where because of the type of pesticide they use and when they use it on the product, the human exposure at the consumer end is low. That became the Dirty Dozen, the ones you want to buy organic, and the Clean 15, where you could buy conventional and you'd still avoid pesticide exposure. We just did this because I kept getting asked, what can I do while the government's making up its mind? For decades. For decades, right? Some of these chemicals have been in regulatory jeopardy, since I was in my 30s, which was a while ago. And so let's put this list out. And it exploded. People loved it. It was on refrigerators. People would come up to me and say, "You're the Dirty Dozen guys, aren't you? And although we weren't guys doing it, mostly it was women on the staff who were doing it. It was amazing. And then, we saw as the media environment got tougher to break through on, well, now we've got the internet, we can go directly to people. So this brilliant scientist, Jane Houlihan, said, well, why don't we look at the chemicals in personal care products? Because she read a study that was published by the CDC that showed that phthalates, this plasticizing agent, was used in nail polish and other cosmetic products, and it was showing up at worrisome levels in the blood of women of childbearing age. And the CDC scientists, it might be personal care products. And we're thinking, what? Is that an environmental issue? Personal care products? Well, maybe it is. If it's ending up in us, why not? She starts building this huge database that became Skin Deep. We thought we were going to use it to change policy. The first use was by shoppers, people who said, how do I avoid this stuff in my fingernail polish? How do I, and what's all the rest of it in my shampoo and my skincare and my lipstick and my eyeliner, my mascara, on and on. So it just sort of rolled out from there. And I joke, it really was not a master plan. It was being led by the interest that people showed us where they were starting from. People online just shopping, and we get 1,000 people an hour coming to the Skin Deep website, and we probably get 4,000 people every day downloading the Dirty Dozen, because people want to help themselves. And it's not really just about EWG. I think it's how environmentalism has changed, Mark. And it's not just in food and personal care and cleaning products. It's even in energy. We've seen a shift so that the possibilities in front of us now are as exciting and plausible as we had long hoped they would be, right? Solar mm-hmm. panels are now real. 10 years ago, when we were debating the last big climate bill, no one hardly mentioned it on the floor of the House or Senate, right? Batteries were something you put in a flashlight instead of how you could store energy on site, even at huge mm-hmm. power mm-hmm. plants. Here's the change. What we're fighting for now is as important as what we've been fighting against.
Yeah, it's true.
Right? You're fighting for good health. We know how to, if we can do it, we can fix healthcare. We're fighting for healthier food. We have models out there that show us what's healthier. Energy, automobiles, we're electrifying the fleet. We're getting rid of fossil fuels. All of that exciting momentum is happening now, in part because environmentalists push back against the bad stuff for a long time, but also because that same push unharnessed, released this tremendous creative energy that can reinvent our economy, reinvent medicine as you're doing. I mean, for goodness sake, you know, if we had 10% of our doctors operating in your mode, no, I'm going to say 5, right? That population health we'd begin noticing, right? You know, at that level. So, and you're, when patients come to see you, I'm not one of your patients, I probably should be, but when patients come to see you, I know what you tell them is the positive things they can be doing to take charge of their own health. What, you know, what they're fighting for is as important as the diseases they're fighting against. You're giving them something to grab onto. You're giving them a sense of empowerment and control.
Yeah.
And those small steps that they build their habits around, one success, small though it may be, after another, is what's, I think, the future of the modern environmental movement now. It's from Rachel Carson's day. We have to fight against the bad chemicals like she did, and we will not stop doing that ever at EWG. But we can also tell you that there are plausible alternatives out there now.
The only thing that I learned about toxicology in medicine and medical school was acute poisoning. We didn't even learn about chronic low-level toxicity. Now, there was some awareness that lead was a problem and that lead in kids caused behavioral issues, developmental issues, impaired cognition, and all kinds of stuff. But we really didn't learn much how to treat it. We didn't learn how to evaluate it. We didn't learn how to test it. And yet, in my experience, and I'm curious to hear your experience, it's one of the most important and unappreciated factors in solving the puzzle of chronic disease for so many people with autoimmune disease, with depression, with dementia, with ADD, with autism, with so digestive issues, with so many things. And it manifests in so many different ways. And people just are not aware of it. And doctors don't even think about it. They might check your mercury level, or they might check your lead level in your blood, but that's not really that helpful most of the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we did learn about, you know, lead and huge, you know, high levels of lead and lead toxicity, like you mentioned. But one of the things we really didn't focus on in conventional medical school training was the concept of toxic load, right? Mm. And all of these toxins we're getting exposed to, and that sometimes small levels of multiple different toxins are really what pushes the body over the edge. So we know that a lot of lead is bad and a lot of mercury is bad. But what we also know, right, is a little bit of different toxins can be really detrimental for some people.
That's right. Can
make that level of lead that isn't crazy off the charts, but be really damaging to their health. And like you said, we see it connected to all sorts of different neurological diseases, developmental diseases. You know, for kids, it's, you know, they're just doing so much growing and development. And if there's a toxin that their body has to deal with, it really impacts that growth and development. Mm. So we see it associated with autism and kids with ADHD and kids with other developmental disorders, even hypertension. We know there's a connection with lead and other heavy metals and hypertension, cardiovascular disease, digestive issues, and the immune system, which I think is so fascinating. Heavy metals and other toxins have been associated with causing depression of your immune system, so getting more frequent infections, and also, like you mentioned, autoimmune disease. So we know that heavy metals can be associated with triggering one of those things we think about when somebody's got autoimmune disease and we're wondering what's going on, what is triggering this. It may be some toxin.
Yeah, I remember this guy when I was at Kenya Ranch years ago, he had ulcerative colitis.
Yeah.
and he was wasting away. And I tried all my functional medicine tricks and the elimination diet and the gut repair and the 5-hour program and this and that. And it just wasn't working. And I'm like, God, okay, I'm going to go back to the basics. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the 5 things that cause all disease? What am I missing? What have I not tested for? Well, heavy metals, you know, they can be immunotoxic. Turned out his mercury levels were off the chart. We chelated him, got the mercury out of his body, and his colitis went away, gained weight, and, you know, was fine.
This is absolutely what you have taught me, right? Over the years of working with you is like when somebody's not getting better, you've got, okay, what am I missing? And so often it's toxins, and a lot of times it's heavy metals, right? Where somebody's not getting better. And yeah. I remember when you told me, you know, you looked in my mouth after having cancer at the age of 30, and you looked at my mouth and you're like, you have to do something about those amalgams. And I dragged my toes for a little while, but it was really helpful for my health.
Who wants to go to the dentist, right?
Right, right.
I mean,
right.
Now the FDA has finally come out and said dental fillings are not safe for pregnant women and children, which begs the question is, why are they safe for the rest of us?
Right, absolutely.
And in many countries, they're banned. In Europe, they're banned. And in Canada, they're recognized as not safe. And so I think, you know, we are in this sea of toxins, like you said, and it's the total load. So one cookie may not be bad for you and give you diabetes, but if you eat 30 or 40, you're going to get diabetes. And the same thing with these toxins. And it's not just one toxin, like you said. And these low-level toxins that we're exposed to, the plastic, the flame retardants, the pesticides, the you know, BPA, phthalates, parabens, all this stuff that we're constantly exposed to does put a wear and tear on our detox system. But the one thing that I found is that these heavy metals are not necessarily low-level toxins. They can actually be extremely high given a patient's exposure and what's going on. So for me, and I don't know what it's like for you, but for me, you know, we see a lot of chronically ill patients here at the Ultra Wellness Center. And for me, it's like checking someone's blood pressure. It's just everybody gets a heavy metal test. I mean, unless there was one patient recently, I'm like, well, I just saw her and I'm like, did not order a heavy metal test on her. Mm-hmm. Although I probably should have, because she had no fillings and she was a vegetarian her whole life and she never ate fish. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, oh, she's not going to have any mercury. But then I was like, wait, she was in the military. Maybe I should have checked because she could have lead.
Yeah.
And she didn't do a lot of blast or gun stuff, but she probably was shooting guns. And I've had, you know, patients. One guy was a king who used to shoot guns all the time, and he had really high lead levels, and he had diabetes and all these other issues.
Yes, I had a hunter as well who had high levels of lead and mercury. I mean, I'm assuming the lead came from the guns, from the shooting,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The fumes from the shooting of the bullets, for sure. So, you know, I remember I had a young student once who wanted to do a research project with us, and I asked her to work with the lab that we use to check heavy metals, because we've done like 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 heavy metal tests over 20 years. And I had them pull, you know, all my patients. I had them analyze the results. And we found that 40% of those patients who showed up with some chronic illness who we tested had significantly elevated heavy metal levels.
I believe it. I believe it.
That may not be the general population. We're talking about people who come in who have stuff wrong.
Who are sick.
But this is called selection bias. But still, if you're going to the doctor and you got a problem that no one can figure out, it's got to be right at the top of the list, you know, gluten, metals, like, you know, gut. It's like, these are the functional medicine things that tend to get ignored with traditional medicine.
Yeah, so we should talk a little bit about how we check, right? You were just mentioning that. I mean, we can check heavy metals in the blood, which is good to check for, especially for acute toxicity or acute exposure. But the blood turns over every 3 months, every 90 days. So when you're checking for heavy metals in the blood, you're really mostly looking at recent exposure to heavy metals. We can check heavy metals. There's a great test we look at a lot. We'll talk a little bit more about it, that looks at the comparison of blood, hair, and urine. And it looks at not only mercury levels in each of those three components, how is the body mobilizing it, and also tells us a little bit more about the comparison of inorganic and methylmercury. We'll talk more about that. We also can do a provoked heavy metal challenge test, where we give a chelator and collect urine for 6 hours. Mm. And that tells us about stores of heavy metals in the body. So if you're wondering if somebody got exposed you know, 2 years ago or 5 years ago, because the body will hold on to heavy metals. You know, we know that lead gets stored in the bones. And so, you know, you get a sense of what exposure somebody's had in the past with doing that provoked heavy metal challenge test.
I mean, this is really important what you're saying, because, you know, most traditional doctors will check your blood level.
Yes.
Now, if you haven't eaten fish in 3 months, mm-hmm. your level is probably going to be zero for mercury. And mm-hmm. if you don't have any acute ongoing exposure to lead, it might be very low. But it may be something that you accumulate over your lifetime that gets stored in your organs, your bones, your muscles, your tissues. And it's not going to come out unless you provoke the body to pull it out.
Yep.
Now, traditional medicine doesn't actually do this test, and they don't even know about this test. And they often are highly skeptical and questioning of this test because, well, what's the normal reference range? You know, you hear all these criticisms. Mm-hmm. The normal reference range for mercury is zero. Mm-hmm. The normal reference range for lead is zero. These are not biologically necessary compounds that we should have in our blood at all, ever, yeah. right?
Less is more there, right? Right?
And we used to do these lead levels on kids. 40 was considered normal. Then it was 20. Then yep. it was 10. And now we're knowing that even down to levels of 1,
yes.
that there's significant impairment in neurologic and cognitive development.
Yes.
In heart disease, and this study blew me away, Liz. There was a study looking at heart disease and lead. And they found that any blood lead levels greater than 2, which is about 39% of the population,
yeah.
were highly correlated with heart attacks, strokes, and death.
Yep.
Far more than cholesterol.
Right.
Which is amazing. And yet, how many cardiologists are checking lead levels?
Yeah, and we think that's because of, right, the process of oxidative stress, right, and inflammation that the heavy metals can cause. And maybe because they're damaging the endothelium and impacting blood pressure, you know, it is really an interesting correlation. And so it is something we really want to look at. The other thing we sometimes look at is antibodies against heavy metals. So if somebody's had exposure to heavy metals or toxins in their lifetime, and you know, you're wondering, could this be triggering an autoimmune disease in their body? We can also look at antibodies against those toxins and heavy metals. And so there's a bunch of different ways we can assess what somebody's toxic load is. Mm-hmm. We also look at oxidative stress markers. We look at genetic factors. You know, some different SNPs or variations in your genes may impact how well you can mobilize and detoxify from heavy metals. Right. So there's a lot of things we look at when we're trying to assess somebody's toxic burden.
It's true, and I've noticed, and these are things that, you know, not well described or written about, but I'm sure you've seen the same thing. You know, you see patients who have heavy metals, and their bodies are trying to get rid of it. So you see all these depleted levels of things. You see depleted levels of amino acids.
Yep.
You see low selenium, low zinc. Yep. You see low glutathione levels. You see all these phenomena that are consequences of this constant burden on the system, and the body's trying to handle it. And you know, when we start to talk about these things, and we're going to talk about lead and mercury. We've been sort of focused on lead. But, you know, if you have any chronic illness, whether it's depression, heart disease, cancer, diabetes. I mean, diabetes is highly correlated with arsenic levels, for example, and pesticides and chemicals. You know, whether it's neurodevelopmental issues, neurocognitive issues like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, whether it's autoimmune diseases, whether it's chronic digestive issues, whether it's chronic fatigue, these all need to be triggers for you to think about heavy metals.
Yes.
And your doctor is just not going to do that unless they're a functional medicine doctor.
That's true.
And we do something different, which is this provocative test, which, you know, is an invasive test. It's sort of like taking a glucose tolerance test, right? When you drink 2 Coca-Cola equivalents and then you check your blood sugar. Well, drinking 2 Coca-Cola is not a great idea, but it's helpful to diagnose how your body responds. So, or like a cardiac stress test. You provoke someone on a treadmill and see if their heart is working or not. And we have to provoke the body to pull these metals out with a chelator, which binds to these metals, and you excrete it in your urine. You collect your urine for 6 hours. And you can follow it over time and see people's levels improve, and you see that correlate with clinical improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And we're going to get into it. But I mean, the way I got into functional medicine was because I had mercury poisoning. And I've told the story a little bit, but we'll get into it when we talk about mercury. But let's sort of get into a little bit about lead. So what makes you think that someone has lead poisoning? And how big of an issue is this in America today?
There's always been lead around in our environment. There's a lot less now than there used to be. You know, I mean, some people feel that the fall of the Roman Empire was because of lead poisoning, and that caused such disorders in the emperors that they were all crazy, right?
Lead pipes. It was the plumbing and the advance of technology and sanitation essentially that killed them.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And so we do have less exposure to lead now than we used to, but we still are getting exposed. It was in 1978 that we finally said in the United States, no more lead in paint. So for a lot of people, they have a house that was built before 1978, depending on the situation and the they still might be getting their children, and they might still be getting exposed to some lead through the dust from the paint. Lead pipes, as you mentioned, you know, there's still some lead in solder, especially in the older pipes. And then in gasoline, it was in 1991, where we finally took all the lead out of gasoline. So we have less exposure to lead than we used to, but we still see some issues with lead toxicity. Well,
where is it coming from now?
Well, so, you know, in older homes, so homes that are built before 1978 or newer homes but still have some older pipes in them,
yeah.
So it can still be in the water. That's why we always recommend people run their, water.
Like in Flint, Michigan, when they... Mm-hmm. Right? And they started messing around with the pipes and the water.
Yep.
And these kids got lead poisoning. And in Cleveland, you know, the kids there have higher lead levels than in Flint, and because of all the old paint and all the old houses. I mean, it's prevalent. We also have the coal burning.
Yes.
And cement plants,
yep,
which use coal and release tremendous amounts of lead and mercury into the environment.
Absolutely. So lead can be in soil, you know, depending on what was happening around that home that your house was built in, it might be deposited in the soil. And we do find situations where kids are playing. I mean, we want them playing in the dirt and in the soil, but that can be a source, especially if they're, you know, their toys or their hands are then going in their mouth. And of course, if they're, you know, kids are always putting stuff in their mouth. So that's where a lot of times they will pick up some of that dust from old paint, you know, at the house.
I remember this one kid who was severe ADD, behavioral issues, mm-hmm, and he lived actually near Albany, and they had this big cement plant there.
Yes.
And it was right next to the school, and every day the cars in the parking lot would be just covered with dust.
Yeah.
And it was basically lead and mercury dust, and this kid had really high levels of lead and mercury from being in a school that was next to a cement plant.
Yeah.
So we don't think of that.
No, and hobbies, you know, we were talking about, you know, shooting guns and the bullets and stuff, but also stained glass, you know, and there still is, unfortunately, lead in some ceramics, and depending on where pottery and ceramics are coming from, you know, there still can be some levels.
And you know, and also wine glasses.
Yes.
And water glasses,
yep,
that are made of crystal. I remember once walked into this store to buy wine glasses, and they were $5 glasses, and they were $50 glasses, and I'm like, why are these Rydell Crystal $50? He said, well, they have lead in them and it makes the wine taste better.
They're a little sweeter, right?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, lead tastes sweet. So it's a serious problem.
It is. It is. And, you know, if a mom has had exposure to lead, you know, we do know it can cross the placenta. So that can be a source for children as well. So many times when we're evaluating a child who has developmental delays, you know, we're also thinking about the mom and what was her exposure like? What are her levels like? Because that is obviously impacting the child.
Absolutely. And I think the prevalence and the issues of this really got exposed by Dr. Phil Landrigan and others, Needleman, in the 70s, where they just took dental samples of kids' teeth that, you know, fell out, baby teeth. They analyzed the teeth and they looked at the lead levels, and they found that there was an incredible correlation with the lead levels in the teeth and these neurodevelopmental issues with kids, whether it was dyslexia, ADD, violence, behavioral issues, academic performance, juvenile delinquency, all increase with higher levels of lead.
Absolutely. As your blood lead level goes up, your IQ goes down. I mean, you know, that correlation is significant.
So it's pediatricians do check for it, right?
You know, it's interesting. I think there's some state to state requirements, you know, like in terms of some states, it's required to check at age two. But then I think in other states, it's only the quote high risk population that we're checking at age two. So there may be some variations in state to state requirement. But when in my training in New York, we were checking everybody at age two.
But what did the doctors do? They're like, oh, don't eat lead paint and don't, I mean, they didn't treat them.
Yeah, unless it was crazy high, right? Like these mild elevations were, we were really watching. I mean, that's how you were trained in conventional medicine. Just if it was a mild elevation, to watch and look to make sure there was not a continued source of lead exposure.
But the beauty of functional medicine is that we actually can treat it and help the body eliminate the metals.
And as you were mentioning earlier, these mild levels of exposure can have significant impact on a growing, developing child. So we also always focus about high fiber. We know fiber will bind to lead and will help eliminate it. So we're always talking to moms and about giving their children lots of fiber, lots of vegetables. We talk about making sure their iron levels are sufficient, because if iron levels are low in a child, then the lead has an easier time getting absorbed into the body and getting into the brain. We know we want to make sure all mineral levels are sufficient. And as you were mentioning earlier, we always focus on nutrition, right? Because you need to have enough amino acids and protein to detoxify. You need to have enough phytonutrients to detoxify. Enough of those good minerals helps prevent that lead from being as detrimental for that growing, developing child.
What people don't realize is your body has a built-in detox system. Mm-hmm. It's designed to help your body get rid of crap.
Yep.
And there are very specific ways to optimize that system. And we've had a podcast on this, but it's something that we really focus on in functional medicine, which is foods that upregulate your detox pathways. Yep. All the things we're mentioning, the right amino acids, the right mineral-rich foods, things with lots of glucosinolates and things that build glutathione in the body, fiber to help bind the metals and get them out. So we have a real strategy. And then there's a lot of nutrients and supplements that we use to also help upregulate these pathways, in addition to getting rid of the source. You got to get rid of the source.
Absolutely.
And then sometimes we even use medication to help chelate or bind the metals to get them out. And these are FDA-approved medications that are used for lead treatment in kids, but they don't usually use it. And
unless the levels are really, really high in the blood, right?
Right. So if a level of one is bad, why wouldn't you treat that, right? Mm-hmm. If you wait until level is 40 or 50, it's like, it doesn't make any sense.
You can get toxicity and have any type of condition. I think what is probably most common are neurological, you know, and that is a spectrum too, where you can see kind of brain fog. I think that's a very common, you know, description of what a lot of folks feel. But it can go all the way up into things like Parkinson's.
Yeah.
Which, you know, with Parkinson's, you know, conventional medicine, we don't know really how to address that. So when we're seeing neurological things, that's one of the things that a good health history kind of tunes us into, of like, oh, is this something, we're probably thinking some toxins are involved here. So that's probably the most common thing. But, you know, autoimmune conditions, I mean, for so many people, it's toxicity is the one of the main puzzle pieces that we're thinking about.
For sure.
Right? I mean, it's food allergies, it's toxins, it's, you know, infections. Those are kind of the big
microbes,
ones. And metals always have been a big one. You know, I know you've been checking for mercury and lead forever, but now we have more testing looking at different types of pesticides, different types of solvents, plastics. And like you said, they're out there and unfortunately more and more prevalent. And I think too, you know, the toxicity you're talking about that kind of is more recognized in conventional medicine, we kind of look more at body burden, right? Like
what these is the total load of these things
this
over your
is
lifetime?
Building up and maybe not very high in someone's blood sample when you check, but it's being stored in fat tissue and in organs and things like that.
Yeah.
So now we have more testing and look at different metabolites in the urine and things like that that would indicate that there's toxins in there.
And it's true, you know, it affects a lot of different things. And, you know, my friend Joe Pizzorno wrote a book. I think it's called The Toxin Solution, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not the title.
Yes, you know this.
Joe Pizzorno.
Sorry, Joe.
Anyway, it's a great book, but he really went into the scientific literature. This is not some, oh, you're toxic and you need to detox and it's some fad little diet thing. No. This is really deep science about the role of environmental toxins in human health across everything from obesity and diabetes, which is a huge cause of that, We call these obesogens, mm-hmm. right? To autoimmune disease, you mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's at low levels, these can be immunotoxins, and they're often called autogens,
right?
As opposed to obesogens,
right?
They cause autoimmune disease, and they cause neurologic issues, whether it's autism or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or various kinds of neuropathy. It can cause gut issues because it affects your ability to digest your food.
Right.
It can cause hormonal issues, cancer, sex hormone issues, right. Environmental fertility. Toxins are well recognized to be interfering with a lot of our cancers and being a contributor to cancers.
Right.
And like you said, infertility. So across the spectrum of diseases, whatever you show up in the doctor's office with, the likelihood the toxins are on the checklist to think about is pretty high.
Right, right. So, and we do that, right, in our packet that we have everyone fill out at the Ultra Wellness Center.
We do a very detailed toxin history, right?
Right, like what, you know, are you getting exposed? Do you have an exterminator come in? Do you, you know, get your clothes dry cleaned? How often are you eating fish? What type of fish are you eating? And just from a good health history, right, that really can key you in of like, okay, this is somewhere we have to look at. So, you know, just kind of being a detective, right, and having the time to spend with someone.
Yeah.
I mean, just even here, you know, the doctors spend so much time with the patients going through everything. But when I meet with them for their food, you know, it's usually the first time they're telling what they're eating. And I'm like, you know, so you're eating tuna? How often? You know,
right, right.
Twice a week? We should probably
so
check
many
you
stories.
For a mercury.
I remember this guy was really poor once and all he did was eat tuna every day. And after like many years, he was just mercury toxic and was chronically ill.
Yeah.
You know, just remind me of this patient I had. She lived in the Bronx when she was a little kid and her family was very poor. And she had cockroaches crawling all over her when she was a kid and mice and this and that. And she just was so obsessed with getting rid of all that.
Mm-hmm.
So she moved to the suburbs in Long Island and she decided to have an exterminator come and spray in and out of her house every single month. And she had a huge barrel of atrazine, which is now banned, which is a toxin. And in her garage, she had so much nasty stuff in there.
Yep.
And she had really bad Parkinson's at 50 years old. And I've seen this over and over when I hear people's stories. Farming is a dangerous profession, not because of farm machinery, because of the exposure
glyphosate,
to chemicals, right? Glyphosate and all the pesticides.
Yeah,
farmers have some of the highest rates of Parkinson's disease.
Right.
So it can make you overweight. It can make you have diabetes. It can cause heart disease. It can cause cancer. It can cause autoimmunity. It can cause neurologic issues. It can cause cognitive impairment. It can cause depression, chronic fatigue. I mean, you name it.
Right.
I had chronic fatigue syndrome,
right?
And among other things. And so that was really sort of a wake up call for me to really understand and study our body's detoxification system. But, you know, in traditional medicine, you know, what's really done about this?
Right. And that's the tricky thing too. You're talking about like, you know, affecting the gut and, you know, gaining weight. I mean, your ability to detoxify starts going down. So you have this toxic burden and it's increasing, and then people's guts are leaky and they're not eliminating as they should. And that toxic burden becomes that much more of an issue. So it's, you know, really a lot of it is obviously avoiding exposure where you can, which is tricky in this day and age, but also really ramping up the body's ability to detoxify. And again, nutrition is a huge part of that.
Yeah. And it's so interesting with traditional medicine because it's just off the radar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's food. I mean, food doctors understand that food, you know, if you eat too much sugar, you get diabetes. And, you know, if you don't eat fiber, you get constipated. I mean, there's some understanding.
Right.
There's like zero when it comes to the role of environmental toxins.
Right.
Is a focus for diagnosis or treatment. And in functional medicine, we really focus on this extensively. And we do it through, like you said, a very detailed history and through various kinds of testing. So we test a lot of things, both the load of toxins, we test our ability to detoxify, and we also look at genetics. So can you talk about some of the diagnostics that we use that are different here at the Ultra Wellness Center and functional medicine?
Right. Genetics is a really important one. I mean, it's never going to really give us a definitive diagnosis, but when people have, and we kind of get into it in a little bit more with some of the food, certain genetic variations that compromise their ability to make something like glutathione, right? Glutathione is our most like potent detox molecule. And there's some of us, we make it, but some of us don't make it very well, given our genetics. So that's something called GSTM1. There's these certain SNPs, and there are several in the detox category, several in the oxidative stress category, several in methylation, and they're all connected to detoxification.
Yeah. Basically, what you're talking about are like slight variations in our genes
right.
that affect our ability to detox.
Right. So for example, I think we see those people, right? Yeah. We're seeing the folks that are at a higher risk because of their genetics and not being able to detoxify.
Yeah.
So even if we don't know their toxic load, if I see some of these genetic variations, I'm proactive and I put, you know, some more food or supplements that are more directed towards their genetics, which is really the way, you know, functional medicine, I think, is you know, going. So the genetic testing is really important. We do a lot of different heavy metal testing, urine toxic metal testing, which is the provoked urine test.
Yeah.
That's what really looks at the body burden. So there's a chelating agent, which basically binds on to heavy metals and will pull them out of the body. Because if you just try to look at metals in the urine, unless you just had a really high exposure, right, you're not going to see it in the urine. So this kind of pulls out what might be stored for someone. So it's looking at mercury and lead and arsenic and thallium. Mercury and lead are probably the ones we see most often.
Checking your blood, is that okay? Or
you can check your blood. I won't get into this case study. I mean, we have folks that come back high in mercury and lead or arsenic. So you can check blood levels, but, you know, blood's turning over, what, every 3 months or so. So if you have ongoing exposure or you happen to catch it right when someone was getting a more acute exposure, you'll see it. But many times it's not there, right?
Right. So you have a normal blood test,
right?
But actually be storing all these metals in your tissues, your organs, right, your liver, your right. brain, your kidneys. And, you know, the doctors will say, well, we checked your blood. It was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sort of like the joke where the guy, you know, has dropped his keys on the street. And he's looking under this lamppost and his friend comes by and says, what are you doing? He says, I'm looking for my keys. He says, where'd you drop them? Well, I dropped them down the street. He says, why are you looking over here?
This
he goes,
we
well,
see.
Because the light's better. Well, that is not the right
approach.
Gotta
look in the shadows, right?
Right. So what happens in traditional medicine, we look at the blood test because that's what we do, but it's actually not necessarily the most accurate view of what's going
on. Right, including with nutritional testing, right? You're not going to see a lot in the blood. So the functional testing we do with a lot of nutrients is very different. So, you know, that's a good example of heavy metals. We do now what's known as a trimercury test, which I think is excellent. It's looking at recent exposure, but they're doing a blood test, but they break it down between methylmercury and inorganic mercury. So methylmercury is typically the form that we're getting exposed to from environmental stuff like fish and food. And, you know, if there's coal burning areas, then inorganic mercury, if your amalgams, your silver fillings are maybe still off gassing, that's you're going to see the inorganic mercury be high. So they're checking.
So what you're saying basically is that if you have what we call silver fillings, which are really mercury fillings. They're not silver. Right. They're over 50% mercury. Over the course of your life, you're chewing gum, you're grinding your teeth maybe, and they off-gas. And we know this is true, and we can measure the mercury from your fillings. And when you see someone who has no fillings, they don't have any of this inorganic mercury. I mean, people have a mouthful of fillings. It's high.
And they get them out, and the inorganic mercury goes away.
And they get better off.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's been really, this test has been really helpful for our practice over the last few years of, you know, trying to determine how much mercury that person is now getting exposed from their amalgams. And then they look at how well you're excreting it. So what are the levels in the urine and the hair? You might correct me, but I think inorganic is usually coming out through the urine. Methylmercury comes out through the hair. So if you have some current exposure and you're also not seeing it get excreted, you can assume that person probably has a fairly high body burden. And we do this constantly. A lot of it is just more nutritional supplements and food really support that person to detoxify, obviously get them to stop eating fish or, you know, if they need to get their amalgams out, get those out. But the mercury goes down and their clearance goes up. So that's been a really great test for mercury.
It's very good. And, you know, the whole thing about the fillings, I just want to sort of jump back on that because you go to your dentist, like, oh, it's perfectly safe. It's fine. There's no studies on it. And they don't even consider it an issue. But the interesting fact is that most dentists don't use the mercury fillings anymore. They use the white fillings, even though they say it's fine. The other thing I often say to the patients that I have is, well, ask your doctor, why is it okay to put the mercury in your mouth? But when they remove the filling, they can't throw it in the garbage. It has to be regulated by the FDA's toxic waste. So it's okay in your mouth, but it's not okay to throw in the garbage.
Right.
And then what's really interesting is the FDA just came out with a statement September 24th, which basically said that certain groups should not have fillings and that they're a higher risk from the off-gassing and the vapor for mercury fillings, including pregnant women, women who are wanting to get pregnant, nursing women and their infants, children before 6 years old, people who have neurologic issues like we talked about, mercury-related ones like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, or MS, people with kidney issues, and people who have allergy to mercury. That is fascinating to me because this is reviewed at 20 years of data. And finally, the FDA. And the FDA is not a progressive group, right? Mm-hmm. For them to say this, you know it's got to be
it's
bad.
It's pretty bad, right?
Now, it's freaky for people because they're going, wow, do I have to get my fillings out? Do I have to run to the dentist? Just a word of caution. You do not want to go get your fillings out unless you do it with a dentist who follows specific guidelines that are designed to create a safe removal of the amalgam. So you need a special dental dam so you don't swallow them. You need high-speed suction. You need breathing oxygen. The dentist should be wearing a mask. Right. There's a whole these precautions that need to be taken, and they're usually done by biological dentists. And there's a website called iaomt.org, which is a dentist toxicology group that is trained to do this properly. You can find a dentist in your area. But I think that, you know, if you have any chronic issues, if you have high levels, you can do the tri-test, which we do here at the Ultra Wellness Center. But it's really important to make sure that you are doing it properly. And I would never, if you're getting new fillings, never get silver fillings. So this is shocking to me that the FDA is finally, you know, in September.
Shocking and sad, right? Like it's taken this long. But
well, yeah, because it's so politically heated because all of a sudden you've got millions and millions of people with these silver fillings in, and you're going to have a run on dentists and people are going to freak out. So
and it's not a cheap procedure to take these out either, right?
No.
So it's not easy for everyone, even if you can find a dentist. But yeah, I mean, and to your point about, I've had several patients over the years say, I've had these in for 40 years and we test them and they're still off gassing. So, you know, that it's definitely a big issue for a lot of folks. So that I probably is the most testing. We do look at, you know, solvents and pesticides. The testing's been a little bit harder for some of that. Some of the labs, we can't get like we did before, you know, with COVID. I think there's just been some issues, but we do use Great Plains quite a bit for looking at different metabolites, again, of pesticides and solvents. One of the labs that we use through Cyrex, who's typically our food sensitivity testing company, they check for antibodies or immune reactions to toxins. So you don't necessarily have really high levels of these toxins, but small amounts can provoke the immune system for some people.
So autoimmune diseases.
So, so when someone's got autoimmunity and we're suspecting toxins, you know, if they're coming back reactive to a lot of different, again, they're looking at like benzene, which is a solvent, formaldehyde, different parabens and metals. When they're showing reactive, we know, okay, we've got to work with this person to help them detoxify to calm down their immune system, because that's definitely something that's driving their inflammation. So that's been a really helpful test.
Yeah, I mean, a little harder than, for example, like if your blood sugar is high and you're eating donuts and bagels and having soda every day, you kind of know that's why it's happening. But if you have a chronic illness, you don't 100% know if it's the mercury or the pesticides or the chemicals. And so you kind of have to design a way of living that is a low toxin lifestyle. Right. And I think, you know, I would like to go through a few cases of how we sort of would approach these patients. But we really focus on, one, identifying the source, you know, two, identifying the patient's own burden of toxins, the patient's ability to detoxify.
Mm-hmm.
And then we focus on how to upregulate the body's own detox systems and remove the toxins. And I remember one case of a woman who had all these issues and she'd really, really high lead levels. And I'm like, where's the lead coming from? She's a very wealthy lady. And I was like, where it's coming from? And it was just hard to figure out. And finally, I started asking questions. Well, you know, what kind of glasses do you have? And what kind of plates do you have? And, you know, because I remember walking once to buy wine glasses in our local kitchen shop, and there was the $5 wine glasses and there were the $50 wine glasses. And the Rydell Crystal wine glasses were $50. I'm like, why are these so expensive for one glass?
Mm-hmm.
He's all because they're made with lead and they help the wine taste better with the lead.
Wow.
And I'm like, okay then.
Pay for your toxins.
Yeah, so she had all these crystal pitchers and crystal glasses that were full of lead. She had all these plates that were designer plates from Italy and France that had these glaze that was lead glaze.
Right.
We got rid of all that stuff and she stopped using it and her lead levels came way down.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's the thing though, right? It takes asking some questions and doing a little detective work to figure out. So once you get an exposure, it is, you know there's a high level. Where is it coming from? Which again, you can't always determine, but many times you can. And again, I think the food quality, we'll talk a little bit about that with the case studies, but you know, our obviously, you want to avoid foods that are sprayed and everything, but like Joe Bizzorno talks a lot about this, is that once foods are sprayed, you know, the natural compounds they make, these phytochemicals that work as antioxidants and are really important for our detox pathways, are not nearly as prevalent because they don't make as many of those phytonutrients when plants are sprayed with these chemicals. So when you buy organic, local, you know, sustainable food, you're minimizing the toxins coming in, but you're also now getting more medicine.
You're getting a double benefit.
Right.
So you're getting more of the chemicals that help you heal and detoxify and less of the toxins.
Right.
And the reason the wild organic foods have more of these protective chemicals is they have to work harder to stay alive.
Right. They got to protect themselves.
They're not
giving
all kinds of like chemicals like pesticides and herbicides that make it easier for them to survive.
Right, exactly. So the chemicals they make to protect themselves from environmental insults like pests, you know, are good for us. So we kind of want them to be, you know, being exposed to this stuff because then the food quality is so much better.
Thanks for listening today. If you love this podcast, please share it with your friends and family. Leave a comment on your own best practices on how you upgrade your health and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And follow me on all social media channels at Dr. Mark Hyman. And we'll see you next time on The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Hyman. Thanks for tuning into The Doctor's Pharmacy. I hope you're loving this podcast. It's one of my favorite things to do and introducing you all the experts that I know and I love and that I've learned so much from. And I want to tell you about something else I'm doing, which is called Mark's Picks. It's my weekly newsletter. And in it, I share my favorite stuff, from foods to supplements to gadgets to tools to enhance your health. It's all the cool stuff that I use and that my team uses to optimize and enhance our health. And I'd love you to sign up for the weekly newsletter. I'll only send it to you once a week on Fridays. Nothing else, I promise. And all you have to do is go to drhyman.com/picks to sign up. That's drhyman.com/picks, P-I-C-K-S, and sign up for the newsletter. And I'll share with you my favorite stuff that I use to enhance my health and get healthier and better and live younger, longer.
This podcast is separate from my clinical practice at the Ultra Wellness Center, my work at Cleveland Clinic and Function Health, where I'm the chief medical officer. This podcast represents my opinions and my guest's opinions. Neither myself nor the podcast endorses the views or statements of my guests. This podcast is for educational purposes only. It's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner now. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Practitioner database. It's important that you have someone in your corner who is trained, who's a licensed healthcare practitioner, and can help you make changes, especially when it comes to your health. Keeping this podcast free is part of my mission to bring practical ways of improving health to the general public. And in keeping with that theme, I'd like to express gratitude to those sponsors that made today's podcast possible.